Welcome to the Daily Dive Weekend Edition. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and every week I explore the top stories making waves in the news and some that are just plain interesting. I'll connect you with the journalists and the people who know the story and bring you news without the noise so you can make an informed decision. You can catch a new episode of the Daily Dive every Monday through Friday, and it's ready when you wake up. On the Weekend Edition, I'll be bringing you some of the best stories from the week. One big thing to watch out for during this pandemic, there are travel restrictions across much of the world. And because of that, there are a ton of cheap airfare deals. Let's be very clear, you should not be flying during a pandemic. But you might want to start considering booking a short getaway later in the year once things calm down. The deals are out there and they are pretty good. The good thing is that these fares will remain low until people start traveling again. So the prices should remain low for some time to come. For more on what to consider before snagging a travel bargain, we'll talk to Scott McCartney. He's the middle seat columnist for the Wall Street Journal.
I think there are a few rules to consider and a few ways to go about this. But what's interesting is that a lot of these really great deals extend into the fall and even next year. Airlines have pretty well excluded holiday periods. In all the searching I did, you're not going to find ultra cheap tickets for Thanksgiving or Christmas, but you can much of the rest of the year. And so I would say with domestic trips, for a lot of people, it may be worth the gamble. I mean, it is a gamble, but if you can find a $71 fare for a trip in September or October, or a $114 trip across the country, even a $214 trip across the country, those are unbelievable prices. And you really don't have a whole lot tied up. So the gamble is you may not get to go on the trip, right? If things are still in flux. And it's kind of like, so what? If you buy the tickets now, airlines have waivers in place, so you can just use that as a credit. But if you do get to go on the $71 round trip ticket, score, you win.
Yeah, totally.
I think it's a different proposition for international travel. A lot more complexity there with countries shutting down borders to visitors, and really kind of how far do you want to be away from home? Should there be a new flare-up and things like that? So I don't think it's worth taking the gamble right now on international trips, but I think on some of these really ultra cheap domestic tickets, if you're comfortable with it, it's a good thing to try.
What range would you say we should be talking about? Because I was looking through the article, there's some Boston to Orlando in mid-June for $41. That's round trip. That's pretty amazing. There's one for $177 from New York to Los Angeles. That's in early June. New York right now is kind of this epicenter of the coronavirus in the United States. So that might be a little tough. So what kind of time period are we looking at to maximize our chances of being safe with this?
There are several different parameters to this. Airlines have put out waivers for buying tickets through the end of March. American just extended theirs today to April 15th. I think those will continue to go out. We just saw the Olympics postponed, and that was July. I think June is very much in doubt. That's a real gamble. But if things do start turning around in April, it could be. But I would be really careful about June and even July. So I think the smart booking really comes to August, September, October, even November. And, you know, I think by that time we are all going to be so tired of being cooped up that there's going to be a lot of interest in travel. On the other hand, I think the other thing to consider is that there are going to be cheap prices for a long time to come. And so you don't have to do this now. You can wait. There are going to be bargains to Orlando in late summer, early fall for a while. I think airlines are going to have sales to get people traveling again. There's going to be a lot of reluctance to start traveling again. And so they'll try and sort of prime the pump that way. But also what you have to remember is they're pulling out all kinds of capacity from their schedules. You know, 90% of international flying. We're seeing the potential of, even for a temporary period, grounding virtually all domestic flying. So as that capacity comes back into the schedule, it's like new flights to everywhere. There are no bookings for those flights. To get the bookings back into those aircraft cabins, they're going to have to offer really deep discounts in order to fill seats.
And one of these suggestions that you made in your piece, which I thought was pretty good, is consider multiple short trips. You know, nobody's going to go for this big 3-week global adventure, especially with the uncertainty in kind of other countries. You know how they're treating their travel restrictions and whatnot. So maybe some of these shorter trips, weekend getaways, little tiny things that you can handle easily, you can still be close. And if they do get canceled or something, you haven't put so much into it.
I think that's right. And even when you're on the trip, you have a ticket home in a relatively short period of time, right? So go to an island for a couple of days. And if all of a sudden things turn and you got to get home, well, you've got a ticket to get home pretty quickly. And then just turn around and repack and go off to a mountain somewhere or something like that. That I think you could have a lot of fun with multiple short trips where you're never really in danger of getting stranded somewhere.
You also mentioned don't buy anything that has cancellation penalties right now. I know a lot of them are waiving that, so hopefully you can get in on that. But one thing I wanted to ask is travel insurance. What do we make of that during this time right now?
Don't make anything of it because it's no good. Almost all standard policies have an exclusion in it for pandemic. Travel insurance companies have very clearly said the danger of coronavirus is known, so they're not covering it. It's the same philosophy that if your house is on fire, you can't run out and get homeowners insurance, right? Because you know the house is on fire. So now you know what the danger is. Just like if the hurricane is bearing down on the island, you can't run out and get insurance. You got to do it before. So standard insurance offers no coverage in these situations. The only travel insurance you could consider at this point is what's called cancel for any reason. That's more expensive. The coverage of your losses is less. But the reality is that you're really not going to have a whole lot of losses if you're careful about protecting yourselves. Airlines will at worst give you a voucher for the value and in many cases give you a refund. If you make sure that your hotel is refundable, your tour, your whatever you've got packed in there, even expensive safaris or whatever, if you protect yourself that way, you don't need travel insurance.
Scott McCartney, middle seat columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Great to be with you, Oscar.
During a surge of coronavirus cases that could tear through prisons and jails, there's a lot of counties and states that are releasing thousands of inmates. They don't want these jails to become the next cruise ships where people are getting sick and it can affect everybody. Health and corrections officials have issued these warnings about cramped and unsanitary conditions that could spread the virus and put inmates, corrections officers, and prison healthcare workers all at risk. For more on who is getting out of jail, we spoke to Kimberly Kindy. She's the national investigative reporter at The Washington Post.
With this movement, and I guess I would say it's a movement, we're seeing people who have all kinds of perspectives. Conservative people, progressive people, defense attorneys, and public defenders who aren't necessarily always on the same side. And they're actually coming together in some areas in a very swift way to try to identify the people who they think they can safely release so they can create some space in the jails and the prisons so that they can have a place where they can isolate an inmate if they become ill. Or if somebody gets exposed, they have a place there to quarantine inmates until they're sure. And then also to create social distancing within the prisons. We're being told to stay 6 feet apart. They need space within the prison so they can create that within the prisons so that they can also remain safe. And as you pointed out, so that not only inmates remain safe, but everybody who works in the prisons remains safe in the jails. I mean, they leave every day. They go home to their families. They go back into the communities. And so this is a national health concern.
Talk a little bit about who would be eligible for this. To be clear, there's not going to be violent criminals being released through this. They're looking for people that are within the last 30 days of their sentence already, or nonviolent criminals, things like that.
You know, in the county jails, a lot of them, they're looking at somebody in prison just or in jail just because they couldn't make bail. There are a lot of people who just if they could make bail, they would be out. They're looking at people like that. They're looking at folks who are definitely low risk offenders, nonviolent offenders. So if you have somebody who, for instance, is 8 years old and they are a nonviolent offender, maybe they're a white collar criminal, and they're looking at trying to get them released back into society. And in some cases, back into society, but on home confinement.
A lot of these people could be eligible for something like that. You still have to do the home confinement. as part of it. And there's also the term being thrown around, compassionate release. So this would be also for elderly inmates and inmates that have underlying medical conditions.
There's a big push within the federal system to expand pre-existing programs. There's a pilot program for the elderly that they can apply for. It hasn't been fully utilized. There are advocates who are pushing for them to expand that. Yes, that's people who, it used to be 65 or older. With the 2018 First Step Act, which was a criminal reform effort legislation, that it went from 65 to 60. And so people who are eligible are 60 and over now. Now, there's a number of criteria that they have to fall into. Nonviolent people, they can't be people who just arrived. And then there's also the Compassionate Release Program, which you just mentioned. That's for people who, generally speaking, we're talking about people who are gravely ill. I interviewed a guy, a 70-year-old former doctor in prison because of Medicare fraud, and he has a slew of health conditions that make him particularly vulnerable to this virus. Diabetes, all kinds of heart problems. His wife has Alzheimer's, so he's also trying to get out to take care of her. This is the kind of person who they're trying to get home into home confinement.
This is also changing policing and also how prosecutors attack stuff. As one district attorney put it, we're not putting low-level punks in jail at the moment. How do police officers and even the correctional officers, I guess, how do they all feel about this approach?
It's a mixed bag. I certainly have interviewed officers who feel like they did the crime, they need to do the time, they still have that position. And so you do not have a universal acceptance of this, to be sure. But I think that most of the people who are trying to manage the jail population and keep it safe, they are trying to change the thought process on this and are trying to convince the law and order types that these are extraordinary times, that if you have somebody who has a warrant out for a number of traffic tickets, this isn't the time to throw them in jail. This is the time to maybe revisit that. And yes, there's some conflict, and there's certainly some people who are pushing back, but there is an indisputable movement towards trying to find a solution to finding the right people to release early so that the jail population does not become the next cruise ship. And there's a great fear that it's going to become like that because of the conditions not as sanitary maybe as most places, people packed really closely together, a lot of people who are not the healthiest people on earth. And it's by everyone's thought process, a recipe for disaster. So I think what's amazing is that what you're seeing is both conservatives and progressives actually come together on this and trying to find a solution. There may be some dispute about how far to go or what the path should be, but there is rigorous discussion about how to handle this.
Kimberly Kindy, national investigative reporter at the Washington Post. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Finally, for this week, something that we're learning a little bit more about COVID-19, the coronavirus. We've known for some time that those with underlying health conditions are more at risk of getting more severe symptoms from COVID-19. But the new data from the CDC shows that those with diabetes, lung disease, and heart disease face an increased chance of being hospitalized. The CDC found that of the people requiring admission to an ICU, 78% of those had at least one underlying health condition. Among all the cases analyzed, 10.9% of patients had diabetes, 9.2% had chronic lung disease, and 9% had cardiovascular disease. One of the big questions, though, that went unanswered, the report did not reach any conclusions about whether the severity of an underlying condition correlated to a more severe COVID-19 illness. For more on this, we spoke to Joel Achenbach, reporter for The Washington Post.
This is consistent with what we saw in China a month or so ago or 6 weeks ago, and then in Italy, and now in the U.S. The simplest thing it tells you is this is the same virus everywhere on the planet. It's playing out the same way. It's also telling us that this new report focused just on people with underlying chronic diseases like renal disease, being immunosuppressed. And this is a lot of people. Keep in mind, when you talk about people with heart disease or lung disease, and lung disease could include emphysema, asthma even, basically, we're talking about tens of millions of Americans are at elevated risk of being hospitalized if they get the disease. Now, I want to make clear, if you are in one of these categories, and I know a lot of people who are, it doesn't mean that the virus is going to kill you. It just means that you're more likely to wind up hospitalized, more likely to wind up potentially needing to go into intensive care. No one wants that. We already kind of knew this, but it just reinforces the point that those who are more vulnerable need to avoid getting infected, which means you stay at home. You have to treat people you know who are vulnerable with special handling. Don't expose them to the virus. It's a real challenge, and it's worrisome, but the social distancing should work. It's a very simple way to deal with the problem.
I don't know if this came out in the CDC data, but does any of it suggest that people, when they do pass away from this, are they passing away from complications of their underlying health conditions, or is it the COVID-19 that's actually doing it? Because from my understanding is, if it gets really bad, it's a respiratory thing. Most people kind of get these pneumonia-like symptoms. That's why they need to be put on ventilators and whatnot. But is it the underlying conditions that is killing them if they get that bad?
That is the question. I will tell you that the new CDC report that we reported on yesterday doesn't answer that question. It's not that granular. This is a first initial snapshot. All it really tells you is that a high percentage of people who have an underlying condition, relatively high percentage, wind up in the hospital compared to people who don't. Okay, now, that doesn't mean that if you have an underlying condition, you're going to wind up in the hospital. Right. It shows that correlation. And two more subtle points here. It could be that, let's say I get COVID and I have like a heart disease. It could be that I will go into the hospital because the doctor says, oh, this is a person who has an underlying condition and we need to treat this person with special care. My COVID case may not be particularly bad. Okay, so we don't know that the COVID is driving people into the hospital as opposed to the underlying condition plus COVID just puts that person in a special category and the hospital says, you know, we want to check you in, right? That could be that. Secondly, the CDC report doesn't say that the severity of your underlying condition translates to a more serious outcome. I think that's common sense that it probably would, right? But they just couldn't crunch those numbers yet. They can't slice and dice the data that fine yet to say, yeah, if you have stage four of this or stage three of that, you're going to wind up with a commensurately worse case of COVID. So that's all kind of fuzzy. It tells you what you kind of already know. And then your question is the right one, which is, if you die of this, is it the COVID that's killing you, or is it your previous condition? In a way, it kind of doesn't, I think it doesn't matter. You got a double whammy somehow, unfortunately.
So for this study, the CDC analyzed more than 7,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases where health officials had written records about a pre-existing condition of any kind. And it did seem that diabetes, chronic lung disease, and cardiovascular disease were the top three, at least.
That's right. But they're also very common. So those are very common illnesses. And they have a whole list of things they consider an underlying condition. Their one big conclusion is that if you have an underlying condition, I forget the exact number, but if you have an underlying condition, you're far more likely to wind up either in the hospital or in the ICU, and you're more likely to have a fatal outcome. Among the people who died and among the 7,000 patients they looked at. Overwhelming numbers were people who had some underlying condition. So, and we kind of, that's consistent with what we knew already. The reason we looked at 7,000 people is those are the people who had records taken where they had filled out a form, and we know if they did or did not have an underlying condition. Some people didn't. And the people who didn't have underlying condition who did not have, a chronic disease, they were much less likely to be hospitalized.
Joel Achenbach, science reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this weekend. Be sure to check out The Daily Dive every Monday through Friday. Join us on social media, at Daily Dive Pod on Twitter and Daily Dive Podcast on Facebook. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow The Daily Dive on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcast. This episode of The Daily Dive has been engineered by Tony Sorrentino. I'm Oscar Ramirez in Los Angeles, and this was your Daily Dive Weekend Edition.